KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
They heard porn, and their reaction was, oh, hot, porn show, great. And I was like, maybe we're not meant to be in business
together. Maybe this
together.
Is just a miss here.
Yeah, I don't think you're hearing porn the way I'm saying porn.
When David Simon started shopping his new show, The Deuce, about the rise and legalization of the porn industry, he quickly realized that a lot of networks didn't quite grasp his seriousness of purpose. The creator of The Wire and Treme tells us how The Deuce ended up back at Simon's longtime TV home, HBO, why he was interested in making a show about porn in the first place, and the importance of Maggie Gyllenhaal. But first on the News Banter, another director is ushered out of the Star Wars universe. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by a special guest co-banterer, Richard Rushfield of The Ankler, which is a daily newsletter about Hollywood, very clever daily newsletter about Hollywood. Matt Bellany is out of pocket right now because of the Toronto Film Festival, but Richard is on the case. And we'll start with the case being Star Wars. You know, Lucasfilm dispatched another director, Colin Trevorrow. This was in the script stage of episode 9 of Star Wars. I really have trouble with the numbering of Star Wars episodes, I admit. You know, this follows the dispatch of Josh Trank before he even started. He had Fantastic Four at Fox that didn't go well, and there were clearly issues that concerned Lucasfilm. And then they dispatched Lord and Miller from young Han Solo, and that was kind of shocking. Lord and Miller have a track record and a following, unlike these young guys that they tend to go to. Colin Trevorrow is one of those young guys. They apparently were not happy with where he was taking the script. They tried bringing in another writer. They were still not happy. And, you know, people do know that Gareth Edwards on Rogue One was sidelined, even though he wasn't actually dumped off the project, and that Tony Gilroy, the screenwriter, and some others pulled it together, and it went very well. So, of course, people are saying, what is wrong here?
Well, you know, every new project that anyone embarks in entertainment or media, they start by saying, we want to go completely out of the box. We want to do something totally different. Just go wild with this. Make us something we've never seen before. But when it comes down to it, that's not what too many people want, and especially when it comes down to Star Wars.
Star Wars is Star Wars.
With billions of dollars riding on this machine functioning smoothly.
Right.
And they thought they were copying the Marvel playbook to a certain extent, have young directors put their own vision and put their own stamp on it. But you just get the sense when the rubber met the road on that, that people's own stamps and doing their own little take on what Star Wars is about just did not feel so good. And you just wonder if they're going to take chances like that again or understand, okay, let's just have Ron Howard do them all.
Right. Somebody like that. I think a seasoned veteran who's a grown-up who's, I mean, Lord and Miller, you know, they clearly wanted to do something improvisational, and it clearly was not something that worked from Lucasfilm's point of view. And I do kind of think that Kathy Kennedy is a capable keeper of that flame, gets it, knows what it is. And I think she's probably going to be more cautious about, we talked at one point for a story, and she said that she could really, thought she could interview these young guys and get a sense, and they're usually guys, although people would like to see a woman at some point, but she said she could get a sense of, could they do this? But it turns out maybe she didn't quite grasp how specific the Star Wars universe is.
You find these things as you go along, and you know, you look at Marvel, Joss Whedon took on Avengers, and there are like a half dozen lines in there that would show you that it's a Joss Whedon film. And in the end, most of that could have been directed by anybody.
One does hear that they do a lot in post-production. And I think if you ask who makes Marvel movies, most people would say Kevin Feige, who runs Marvel, makes Marvel movies and his brain trust.
Exactly. And now that they're 20 films into it, they are letting directors take the vision and go further with it. But at the beginning, it was just very small flourishes. And somehow in the onboarding conversations with these directors, that plan was not spelled out clearly enough.
And Trevorrow, of course, had Book of Henry, which is a film that was just brutalized by the critics, and I don't think that necessarily helped either. But he's going to go back and do Jurassic World too, so it's weird because the producer of that is Frank Marshall, who is married to Kathy Kennedy. So it's like the wife fired the husband's director, but presumably that will also work out.
It's only business here.
It's all business. So speaking of business, we have seen Bob Iger come forward in the last few days and say, you know, we have been wondering about their streaming service. Would those Star Wars and Marvel movies be included in the streaming service, which they are launching? And, you know, they pulled back a lot of stuff from Netflix to do it. And that was a question. He's answered the question. The answer is yes, which sounds, you know, if I am a streaming service, I'd be like, okay, that's going to be something to contend with.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing that caught my eye even more, because I feel like it would have been crazy to launch this OTT service and leave 2/3 of your crown jewels out of it.
Right.
But that they're going to be making movies, presumably Pixar and Marvel live action movies for the streaming service. And if those companies that have been so concerned with just limiting the amount of product that they put out, and they're so built on meticulous craftsmanship, are now having to compete with the Netflix pipeline, what is that going to become for them?
It's going to be interesting. But as we know, Disney is the only brand of entertainment that customers have an association with, really. You know, people don't say, I want to go see that Fox movie. But Disney is a stamp of approval for a lot of consumers that they might want to go. And I think the streaming service will, you know, this herd will have to thin. Consumers can't, you know, we've been waiting for the cable bundle to break up, and now we're going to have to pay for how many of these?
Yeah.
But I think if people have a choice, especially if they have kids, Disney is going to be part of what they buy. I will just quickly mention that Neil Moritz, producer of Fast and Furious and for Sony, where he's had his deal for some time, his main deal, 21 Jump Street and some other things, he is walking off there and going to Paramount. Now, Sony and Paramount are the two most challenged studios in this business right now, looking desperately for material. I'm sure Neil Moritz did not care for Tom Rothman, the chairman of Sony, and probably Tom Rothman didn't care for Neil Moritz, but Paramount needs material, and they've made that deal.
There was definitely no love lost at Sony, but it's interesting. Someone going from the number 5 studio to the number 6 studio now, and is this enough that they will switch places at the bottom? Or is it a sign that people have wondered, is Jim Giannopoulos really going to be able to turn around Paramount and dig it out of the hole? And is this a sign that they're willing to invest and bigger things are coming there?
I think they're certainly going to try to find bigger things. But when you are in the bottom rung, it's tough. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.
That's Richard Rushfield, editor-in-chief of The Ankler. Writer-producer David Simon's new HBO series, The Deuce, begins in early 1970s Times Square, then a seamy part of New York that was to become the birthplace of the modern pornography industry. As is usual for Simon's series, the show explores the varied perspectives of the people involved in the creation of porn: prostitutes, pimps, cops, mob members, and the budding X-rated filmmakers. All along, The Deuce follows the money. James Franco plays two roles in the series: Vincent Martino, who manages a bar and has designs on taking his business to the next level, as well as Vincent's ne'er-do-well twin brother, Frankie. Vincent is based on a real person who really had a twin.
Hey, baby brother. Working stiff. The f*** you been?
Queens.
What the f*** you doing in Queens?
Well, they still take my bets there.
You still betting?
Winning. I'm up 4,000.
What made you think, I want to do this?
Nothing made us think I wanted to do this initially. It wasn't on our slate of things we wanted to get made. And, you know, we were developing other things. And George Pelkonis and I were in New Orleans. And our assistant locations manager was a fellow named Mark Henry Johnson. And he approached us and he said, I've been talking to this guy. He was a mob front on 42nd Street for 20 years. And he was there right at that crucible where the porn industry effectively, as when it was sort of made legal, where it began and where it sort of exploded. And he's telling me everything, and he's making tapes, and he's got amazing stories. You got to hear this guy. And George and I looked at each other, and we thought, porn, prostitution, I don't know. We're married. We have lawn furniture. You know, this doesn't feel right. So we were reluctant, and it felt gratuitous. It feels gratuitous to say it now. And so we were really resistant at first, and he kept working. Mark kept working on us, and he said, you got to just promise me you'll come. Give me one day to meet with the guy. So on a trip where we were going to do post-production in New York, George and I peeled off and went and met this fella at Mark's apartment, and he started telling us stories. And about 3 hours after he started telling stories about what that world was, George and I excused ourselves to walk around the block, and I said, what do you think? And George just looked at me and like raised an eyebrow. I said, are we going to have to make a porn show? And, you know, it really was backing into it. Like, we were shaking our heads, like, what just happened? You know, the stories were so compelling. The characters were tragic and comic at the same time. And what I started hearing was one of those things that I geek out about, which is I started seeing the economic construct of a company town, of a rigged system, of the people who have agency, the people who don't have agency, the people who are used, the people who are betrayed, the people who profit, where the money goes. That's the wire. They, you know, I mean, I was never particularly interested in making a moral case against drug use or against illegal drugs or a moral case for drug prohibition. What I was interested in was where does the money go and how does power and profit array itself? To me, that was the wire. It was an argument about market capitalism, absent any other social framework, you know, to create a just dynamic and a just society. What happens? So I started hearing the same things because whenever we would ask about, like, well, what happened to her? The answer was never, oh, it was great. She married a, you know, podiatrist and she lives in Scarsdale and, you know, she's got 2.3 kids and a 2-car garage. And those answers were not available for any of these people who were pioneers. You know, there were some survivors, but it was a hard road for a lot of people. So I was interested and it was worth exploring. And then, a lot of research followed. That was about 5 years ago that Mark took us to meet the fellow. He didn't survive. His twin brother had passed already when we met him. And he died as we were prepping the pilot. But he'd read the first three scripts, so I guess he knew what was coming in some sense.
And was good? He liked it? He didn't like it?
He thought his character should be a little more heroic, but don't they all? Everyone has their own version of themselves that they would prefer to see on camera. But he was okay, by and large. He was okay with the world we had created.
I think you've just given a lot of encouragement to location managers and their assistants to be very aggressive.
I gotta say, most times when somebody walks up to you and says, "Oh, you got to talk to somebody. I have a great idea for a television show,"
you're like, "No."
Your eyes glaze, and you know, at best, this ends with a wasted half a day. And Mark was persistent, and the fact that he was very specific about what the guy had done, who he was connected to, where the money went, and that it was a period from 1971 to 86, that it was very specific. The reporter in me started to like, well, this is a real guy because I'm getting too many details back. This is not a made-up story.
Right.
And it's matching up to certain things that I know to be true about that era. So I knew at least I'm going to meet, you know, somebody who was in the world and there may be some BS, but, you know, it's a guy who was there. And so, okay, let me hear some stories.
So the notion of the twins came from the reality of this guy.
Yeah, it's not a Hollywood trick. And once we heard about his relationship with his brother and what the brother was engaged with and the dynamic between the two, we didn't want to lose the brother. We didn't like want to give that up and simplify it because it's part of the dynamic. I mean, we were talking to a guy who was in his 60s, late 60s, who was fighting cancer. And he was looking back on a life and there was something quite sort of sad about it. He was a survivor, but there were not a lot of other survivors. He had sort of outlived his cohort. And the brother was a big part of that in a way in terms of what happened to the brother's life. And so as we heard it, it was not a part that we wanted to throw back in the war. We wanted to keep that.
Well, so the sex is not, it's not a sexy sex, you know.
Well, thank you. We weren't trying to do that. Utterly transactional sex and it's the commodification of women and it's misogyny. And that's what the show's about. I mean, we're not trafficking in that. We're actually, that's the reason for the show is that's what we're actually critiquing is the essence of what has been the veritable theme of pornography since some French guy invented the camera. So yeah, I think that's what takes the shine off any moment of lust or nudity that, you know, might otherwise convey. I hope it does.
So did management change at HBO in the midst of all of this?
Yeah.
And so you pitched it to
Mike Lombardo.
And did he kind of go, I'm sorry, what? Or did he say, I love you and whatever you want to do is...
Mike said, that's interesting. To be fair, Richard Plepler, who was also there the moment
the head of HBO.
Yeah. I sent the scripts to Mike, and I think Richard, who has been a real supporter of everything I've done since The Corner, I think there was a part of him that said very much, wait a sec, David Simon's doing what? You know, listen, as a lead line, as just a single sentence or a paragraph, this show sounds gratuitous. And so I think he heard it as being a wasted opportunity. Like, you know, shouldn't he be doing something on governance or, you know, Richard's he's a big idea guy.
And he loves politics.
Yeah, he loves politics. You know, he's the guy who, like, when I do Show Me a Hero and it's about federal housing policy, he's like, yes, you know, 6 hours on federal housing. That's, you know, that's the part of HBO we need. I mean, that has to be in our canon as well as the other stuff. And, you know, so, I mean, he's been a real advocate for the stuff that other people would call dry. And I think he heard this and thought the idea of what was in the interior of that world, the politics and the economics and the argument, I think that was not there. Now he's an incredible supporter of the show. But in the beginning, I think there was some resistance from Richard. And let's face it, I didn't know this, but at the same time that we were developing this quietly in our own way, Vinyl was going through the channels and being prepped. And Vinyl, it had Martin Scorsese, and those guys had numbers. Boardwalk Empire had numbers.
Oh, right.
And certainly The Sopranos, which, you know, is part of Terry's history, had the greatest numbers ever to that point. And I'd gone about as far as you could go at HBO. You know, I'd been with them for a decade and a half, never having pulled a number in my life. So we were looking up and there was a sort of a monolith above us. So I was pretty doubtful that we were going to get a fair shake. At some point, my deal was up. I was ready to pull the pilot and try to sell it somewhere else because I just thought, you know, listen, you guys have been great. And, you know, if we see each other on the street, we'll hug and talk about the good old times. But I'm just never going to get anything made about this, about 70s New York.
I won't even say what a money suck Vinyl was, but continue.
You know, they just were. They were the given in my world for about 2-3 years. And George felt the same way. It's like, there's not room for 2 70s shows on HBO, is there?
I just heard the word Netflix in my head, but go ahead.
No, you know, listen, I'll be honest, I had a conversation with Netflix about this. And to their credit, because they do a lot of good work, you know, I think it's never a good look to be bringing something in that somebody else is saying maybe not to.
I mean, I'm just going to pursue for a sec this Netflix. What happened? Did you talk to them?
They passed. I mean,
they did.
I said, you know, listen, this one can travel with me if you're interested. I think they had the Baz Luhrmann show. They had another 70s New York show.
Oh, my God. It's so funny that these shows that did
they
not
all
work.
Came up, well, they all came up separate.
Screwing up shows that might work. Yeah.
You know, in any event, a lot of this was Mike Lombardo's enthusiasm of saying, look, you guys wrote the hell out of this. Now you got James Franco signed up. Michelle McLaren read the script. She wants to direct. Make the pilot here. Because I was asking for, like, you know, we know the 8 hours. Just let us shoot the 8 hours. You don't have to shoot a pilot. But Mike said, let us shoot the pilot. We got to shoot a pilot. Proof of concept. You got to do that. And he said, but, you know, you've done a good job. We've always responded when you did a good job. Have a little faith. So I did. I signed back up with HBO and we made it. And they were ready to go on the pilot. I got the feeling that if they had Vinyl coming back for season 2, we still would have gotten an order.
So what happened, just to make it clear, you were concerned that they would not
have room.
You go to Netflix. That doesn't work out.
I went to a couple other places too. And
I can't imagine what other places.
Well, that's the problem.
I mean, John Landgraf, but that's
the problem.
Still,
I went to a couple places that, like, they heard porn and the reaction was, oh, hot, porn show, great, you know.
Oh, God.
And I was like, no, I don't think, maybe we're not meant to be in business together.
Maybe this is just a miss here.
Yeah, I don't think you're hearing porn the way I'm saying porn. So, like, at some point, I circled back to HBO and I said, you know what? Your notes are the best. When you guys do execute, you're great. And we have a long history together. I'll take my shot and maybe there's room for 2 of us. So we started shooting the pilot. And then we delivered the pilot before Vinyl aired. So there was a moment where they were saying to us, this is good. I think we're going to order your show. And they hadn't killed Vinyl yet. And that was pretty, I was like, oh, really? 270 shows? And then, yeah, before we started shooting.
RIP Vinyl.
Yeah, before I think we got our official order. We got a very encouraging response to the pilot. But before we got our official order, Vinyl was killed. And we ended up with some of their wardrobe, yes.
Did you really?
Yes, we
did. That's hilarious.
Well, they were like right upstairs from
us. Here, we can use this.
We both had our offices over at the Navy Yard, so we ended up with some of their stuff.
Coming up after a short break, TV writer-producer David Simon tells us why he wanted lots of women involved behind the camera in the making of The Deuce and explains what he thinks people didn't understand about Tremé. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? Critics rave The Greatest Hits is a music-infused romance that hits all the right notes and the most original time travel story in years. Featuring music by Nelly Furtado, Beach House, Jamie XX, and more. Watch The Greatest Hits, now streaming on Hulu.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to David Simon, co-creator of The Deuce on HBO. The series premiere is Sunday, September 10th. The title The Deuce could refer to a couple of things. There's a pair of twins, played by James Franco and James Franco, and The Deuce was also the 1970s nickname for Manhattan's then-seedy 42nd Street. The show dives into the world of pornography and the real stories of some of the people who created it and made it legal to film and sell. Maggie Gyllenhaal plays Candy, a prostitute who gets involved in early attempts to make pornographic movies, but wants to be behind the camera.
I want to learn how to make movies. If they can sell that in Europe, it's not going to be long before we can make and sell it here.
How do you know?
It's America, right?
Before agreeing to play Candy, Gyllenhaal told Simon she also wanted to be a producer on the series, not just nominally, but with the ability to have real creative input. Simon accepted readily and consulted with other women as well.
My longtime producing partner is Nina Noble, going back all the way to The Corner. I mean, I haven't shot an hour of television on my own without her. She's effectively become a completely independent creative element in the production. But even more specifically, as the conduit to actors, particularly female actors who are going to be, you know, these were tough roles, and this is a tough role.
I'll say.
Like, George and I are open. Like, we're thinking we're the most thoughtful, egalitarian creatures. Any professional actor should be able to come to us and express concerns. But the truth is, we're the bosses and we're men. So, you know, very quickly on this project, from the pilot on, Nina became, you know, when those the critical scenes that were so delicate that involved nudity and intimacy and or lack of intimacy in this case.
Yes.
Nina was often the person who, she was on intake and she was also on sort of guidance. She was essential. Nina went through every department head that we could make a woman, we did, particularly those that were directly involved in servicing actors, you know, her makeup wardrobe. We wanted to create not only a sense of professionalism to deal with this subject matter, but also a sense of community, that it wasn't the boys telling the story of pornography and prostitution. That's a terrible notion. And we sensed it right away.
Yeah, that would not be good.
You know, since we only had one script to write and since we had all of the stories and we knew how we were structuring, we were going off of the reel. We felt like, well, we can get through the pilot without a writer's room, save money and put it all on the screen. But the moment we had a writer's room, yes, then it was, you know, we hired Lisa Lutz and Megan Abbott. You know, we hired two female writers, a gay writer now for second season because the story's going to go, some of it's going to go to the West Village, a gay writer who was there in the late 70s and early 80s, and a trans writer, a writer who was transitioning and has now transitioned, who I'd worked with before, and an African-American writer, which we were very much interested in broadening the scope of the piece. I'm particularly wary of the fact that this can't be the guy's story.
Well, and Maggie Gyllenhaal, I'm sure, had her. I read.
Oh, yeah.
She had plenty of opinions.
Don't leave out Maggie. She said, look, if I do this, I'm going to go for it because there's no other way to do it. And I'm intrigued by what you're saying you're after with this piece. But, you know, we've never worked together and I know your history and I know what you've made, but I got to trust you. I got to trust George. And I got to trust this process. And the way I can best do that is if I can argue broadly and talk about what I think. And we were trying to take that on. We were trying to add that from female voices all throughout the production. So that was like another one, like, yes, thank you. But the other thing is, in the end, the tell was the scripts. You know, if the script comes out and it becomes something else off of what we claimed for it, nobody's going to know it faster than the actors. So we felt like, okay, it's on us. And we better deliver what we sold, not only to HBO, but to everybody, you know, everybody who's working on this. We all have to be doing the same thing for the same reasons, or we're in trouble. You know, that's like a tell. Like, you know, if the actors themselves begin to doubt for a minute what our intentions are, imagine what this thing's going to be like when it lands on the public. You know, I don't want to be apologizing for something I, you know, wasted 3-4 years on. I mean, that's a horrible outcome. So I didn't look upon Maggie's participation in story as being in any way onerous. It gave me more of a sense of ballast.
I read somewhere, I think you were talking primarily about Tremé, that, you know, when somebody watches a show that you have made, they need to kind of sign on and see where it's going to go and not just immediately react.
Yeah, Tremé suffered from something, which was there was almost an incredible lack of sophistication about, you know, when you would write from the point of view of a drug dealer or a cop, everyone knew that I wasn't a cop and I wasn't a drug dealer. So the presumption was I'm writing character. The first moment that John Goodman appeared in the pilot of Tremé and began ranting, there were actual pieces like in The Atlantic and stuff saying, David Simon wants you to believe, David Simon this, David Simon. And I was like, it's a character. And a lot of what he's saying, if you listen to his rant, I mean, some of it was true. Some of it was the way people, a lot of people felt isolated and ignored and affronted post-Katrina in New Orleans. And you heard those voices. And he was modeled on a particular blogger who, you know, had some great and wonderful notoriety in the immediate aftermath of the flood. But we'd added other elements. And one of the elements we added was an irrationality that we knew at the end of that first season was going to result in a suicide. And in that first rant, he declares San Francisco to be a cesspool with hills. You know, that's a clue. That's a clue that maybe the narrator is not so reliable. And, you know, the other thing was Eric Overmyer wrote the rant, not David Simon. And it was him working off of these various influences. And I watched these essays come out and say, oh, the smug hipster liberals who want you to think, like, this is, you know, what just happened? But I realized, absent the bag of dope or the gun or the uniform, the temptation to view everything through the prism of whatever politics I've offered the world is pretty overwhelming for some critics. It's like, if it comes out of a character's mouth and I wrote it, then I think it. And, you know, anybody writing it in any form can tell you that's a ridiculous notion. But I realized I'd acquired a cost because I sort of freely comment about politics elsewhere, you know, just in my general life. I'm pretty blunt about it. I do public speaking. I'm on the internet. And I realized people are like, they're not watching the show anymore. They're like straining everything through some tweet, you know, that's two and a half years old. So I realized I'd acquired some baggage that I didn't have when the wire came on. Nobody knew who I was. So there's, you know, in some ways, maybe it's better to just shut up.
But it seems like you're taking
too
more,
late.
Yeah, so be it attitude, right?
Well, it's too late.
You know, you do seem made for binging.
People say that. To me, I never experienced it that way. I mean, certainly that's helped me. And DVDs have helped me. And I didn't anticipate any of that. I mean, we were just...
There's such a novelistic quality too.
Well, we're writing the thing as a whole. I'll say this. I think there's a lot of TV in this, again, they call it the golden age, where people, they have a great idea for a franchise. And they have a great idea for a world. And I felt that way before, you know, sort of acquiring some narratives on television. And then you start to realize, oh my God, these people are in the writing room and they're trying to figure out how to sustain the franchise. And I think the difference between stuff that in the end is executed properly and stuff that was a television narrative in the worst sense is really simple. It's like you have to think about the ending as you're writing the beginning.
It's a different model from, like, you know, TV drama, which is just start
right.
it, you know.
Start and you finish, you know, 15 minutes after the audience leaves, you know,
right.
Nobody's watching anymore. Okay, we're done. this is like, you know, I'm back in vaudeville, man. Get off stage and leave them wanting more. You know, make sure the end of the act is better than the beginning of the act. So I'm always writing to the last 15 minutes of every show. And that's how our writer's room works. Like, where are we headed? At the end, what do we want to say? Let's work back from there. And I don't think anybody does that. I don't say anybody. There are some people who clearly
maybe
do that.
Maybe more so in the era of the streaming.
Maybe more in the era of the streaming. This is good for TV, but it would be good if more people, you know, it's so hard to get up a show and keep it up that when people finally get one up, all they want to do is sustain it. And I start to feel that when I'm watching a show and I feel like, and so the trick is to sort of like just figure out where you're going and then try to get there.
David Simon is many things. He's a McCarthy genius, y'all. He's the co-creator of The Deuce on HBO. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me. This was fun.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.